Hello?
Joanne?
Stephen, good morning, good afternoon.
Good morning and or good afternoon.
How are you today?
I am well, looking out of my studio at the real sun.
Feels good, huh?
It does, but it feels even better to be able to work in the studio right now.
Are you in the same studio that I visited back in 2007, I think it was?
No, I got evicted 3 years ago. I moved to Brooklyn with every other artist and work at Industry City, where I will be for one more year before I actually try to move back into Manhattan.
Uh-huh. Do you have good space?
I have the same size space that I had
in
Tribeca,
uh-huh.
But it's cluttered more because I'm doing more small scale sculpture.
I see.
But it's workable.
I remember my studio visit with you as though it were yesterday. I can still envision a good portion of it. And it was like entering a wonderland for me. So I'm eager to talk to you about what's happened since then and more about your artistry. You're about to leave for a big project, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, it's I am doing a project out in Nevada. And I, since seeing you a long time ago, maybe, when I was with Marlboro, I think, or I had just left
Yeah,
Marlboro.
I think it's been about 14 years, actually. But
yeah,
we've stayed sort of peripherally in touch, which has been a good thing.
Yeah, I left Marlboro when I started doing more land art and
mm-hmm.
large-scale installation.
Mm-hmm.
We just had a parting of the ways. And I had done my very first large-scale outdoor piece was at Storm King Art Center, which was not a bad start. And over a 10-year period, 10 to 12-year period, I started working a combination of continuing the practice of working on drawings, which has always been the primary activity, and some small-scale sculpture for the studio, and wonderful opportunities to work on site. And the next site is just south of Reno, where I will be at a site for about 2 months. And I am trying out some new structures that I hope to utilize in an upcoming, hopefully, show. I say hopefully because it's going to be impacted by COVID. I was selected for the biennial in Brazil.
Fantastic.
And originally it was scheduled for next year. Well, it's still up for next year. It was this past one was skipped because of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
I have been given perhaps one of the most amazing institutional sites that I've ever worked at, although most of my projects have been outdoors. This is a combination outdoor-indoor. I've been given the Oscar Niemeyer Museum, which is in the town of Curitiba. And Oscar Niemeyer, who is the Frank Lloyd Wright of Brazil, although their styles are extremely different. But he was the futurist, and he designed Brasilia. And the museum in Curitiba is often referred to as the Metropolitan Museum of South America in terms of scale, in terms of collection. So I took a visit there actually a little over a year ago. And in fact, the people that I went with, including the curator, we were on one of the last flights allowed out of Brazil to enter the United States. So as I say, it's a fingers crossed that this will be more or less resolved by the fall of next year, 2022,
mm-hmm.
because I'm quite looking forward to that. But I've been sort of challenging myself by working with a lot of materials that I had gotten interested in from travels to the Far East. And I think you know that I sort of commuted for about 15 to 20 years. And it really was about, it always had to be rooted in drawing, anything that I built, meaning that it had to be linear or it had to be skeletal. And it had to address sort of a fictional engineering, because I'm not trained in formal mathematics, and I'm not working with any digital processes. I'm building intuitively. But I really wanted to take the drawings that I was doing and turn them into some three-dimensional habitats. So after working with a number of wonderful, you know, architects who I cultivated important relationships with, many of whom were visionary architects, including people like Lebius Woods and Michael Sorkin. These were people who did not build a lot, but were very much interested in the aesthetics of the unbuildable. And so my interest in architecture was sated, and also my passion for drawing. So I did a lot of outdoor work, large scale, and then was invited the year before the pandemic. I did my first large-scale indoor piece, which was a folding house at the Architecture Gallery of Berlin. One of the things that I did along the way was I tried to create more of an interactive activity. And by that, I mean to combine my sort of interest in music and film as a part of any of the installations, so that even though drawing was at the core of all of these pieces, there would be, besides exceptional documentary photography, which is key for working in ephemeral pieces, I would work with filmmakers who would do documentary shorts, and I would also work with various types of musicians or dancers to create performances in which the sculpture was sort of a centerpiece, or, you know, a set, so that there was a narrative between the dancers and the musicians and the sculpture.
And the filmmakers were documenting your whole process?
Yeah, the filmmakers.
And the collaborative work?
Yeah. They did a range of things. In some cases, they were documenting process. And then I worked with two young, and by young, I'm going to say 25-year-old filmmakers who did what we call short attention span filmmaking. They were film shorts that were more centered around the artistic activity, the aesthetics of the piece. They were designed for the internet, and so they did not exceed a minute and a half. But then the documentary films were much longer, and there's a longer one that was produced by Tippett Rise on my project out in Montana. There was a brilliant little short that was done in conjunction with my floating piece in Denver at the Denver Botanic Gardens, one done in Montana by a young filmmaker who tried to combine, and successfully, I believe, the art of my drawing and the landscape of Montana, so that some of the films are very much the documentary reflecting the process. And then some of them are what one would call short art films.
And these were all part of this exhibition? They were part of the installation in Berlin?
The films often would come after the installation, so that they were always posted on the web. There would be links from my website to Vimeo or to YouTube. And they all remain out there. And the most recent film that I participated in, actually, I'm working with a filmmaker currently. Yeah, a filmmaker who is doing a documentary on the impact of COVID on, I think, 3 or 4 different artists.
Mm-hmm.
But I am doing it in conjunction with an installation at Industry City that I did of a glacier using sort of a woven reed. And the singer is an opera singer, and she is singing something of my choice, I have forgotten his name all of a sudden for some reason. I will remember it. I wrote it down. But he's one of my favorite singers. That's how favorite he is that I've forgotten his name. But it's the idea that she's doing a 5-minute film short and singing a song that he wrote. Gustav Mahler, excuse me. Hard name to forget. Gustav Mahler wrote a series of songs, and one song in particular was a song that my mother used to sing, and she was a trained opera singer, actually. And it was a song that was sort of favorite. I don't want to use the word favorite is deceptive, but it was sung a great deal by people commemorating the Holocaust. And it's about the sadness of the world. And so after listening to a lot of Mahler's songs, I selected this one because I thought it went with this whole notion of how we evaluate where we are and what we've come through as a part of the coronavirus. So that is actually being filmed tomorrow at my piece.
Oh, cool.
And so we are preparing for that.
Well, I want to stop you because I want to go back and dig a little deeper because you've said numerous things that I'm interested in exploring a little bit more. Especially in terms of how you create your structure specifically, and you've alluded to that, of course, and the materials that you use. I mean, I remember so well in being in your studio and being struck by the mechanics, the materials, the tools that you use to create drawings and to create sculptures and the materials. And, you know, I have a great visual recall of that, and I think it would be nice to get a little closer to it. You mentioned that you were spent a lot of time in the Far East. So what did you take from those experiences that you continue to incorporate in your artistry today?
Well, the common denominator here is the hand and sense of touch. And as someone who came out initially of a drawing aesthetic, I was always used to that whole notion of intimacy and directness and confession. And the feel of the paper and the feel of the tool on the paper. And all of these values had to be translated for me somehow into a 3-dimensional experience. And how that manifests itself really is a passion for hand building, so that I don't use power tools or any type of formal mathematical processes. What I try to do is build everything through intuition. And that intuition is something that was honed really by drawing, and more specifically, early drawing of the figure. So that I had a formal education in art, but I really learned a lot about drawing by drawing architecture and drawing the human form. So how do we take that experience and translate it into 3D without it look like an imitation? And the way that I went about it, which was really a 20-year process of, you know, how do you get there, is building the way that I used to build as a child, which is using instinct and trial and error. And everything that I build now, there is no mathematics. There are no mathematics involved. No systems. There might be proportion. But most importantly, I want to be able to control every aspect of every piece, and I want my hands to do it. So when something has to be cut, it's cut with a handsaw, or when something has to be assembled, it's a very simple means of assembly. The engineering that I employ is not sophisticated. It is really based on a very basic understanding of geometry. But in the end, everything goes back to gestural drawing or linear drawing, so that the materials It was an easier decision to make, because what I discovered while living in the Far East was I had the opportunity to spend time with people that were building things that were functional out of necessity, as opposed to making sculpture. And out of necessity, I would say they were building houses, or they were building bridges, or they were building towers or water irrigation systems or boats. And I learned about my education in sculpture really comes out of an understanding of design and function. And I realized that the common denominator in everything that was being built by indigenous peoples was that, you know, there was no electricity. And I thought, well, how can we do that on site? Or is that an important thing? And I realized that building with it, you know, as much as I build, I can build in a power failure. I don't need electricity to construct anything. Because, again, I rely on the simple art of using my hands to control every aspect of connection. So that this, to me, is something that comes out of traditional drawing. And so that's where they both parallel and intersect. The Far East was really the influence on material selection, because I wanted materials to be natural. I wanted them to be pliable. And I wanted them to be able to survive any kind of climate.
And can you name some of those materials?
Well, the materials, the primary material that I use are various forms of grass and reed. And that could be as dense a material as bamboo, or it can be reeds that are harvested from various areas and then literally sliced down with a knife and turn them, converting them into a more pliable type of what appear to be ribbons of stick, of tree trunks or stalks. And there's also, for me, I'm not a naturalist, but I discovered things along the way by using these materials that reaffirmed, I guess, a belief in the natural order. And I don't use color. The color that I use is really the result of the color of the material, the growing material. And I also want there to be a sense of life in the work. So that is why I chose the materials that I do. I would say 80% of the work I do is ephemeral, because especially if it's large, I don't want it to last forever. The piece that Tippett Rise is a combination of both, because in that particular piece I'm using cedar logs that are 8 inch in diameter and some of them 40 feet long. But just with linseed oil, this piece will survive generations. But for the
most
part...
Was that the first time you made a foray with material such as cedar?
It's the second time I used cedar. It is the first time I used logs. Mm-hmm. And it was also the first time I worked with people that really knew how to work with logs. I had used flat cedar before to make some structures that will survive and endure, but I worked with a group of timber framers, and these were men and women who were used to building farms and houses and bridges, and a lot of their activity was dictated by the engineering firm Arup, who I've worked with a couple times on projects. But for the most part, we are talking about getting trees from the from British Columbia, I believe, and bringing them to Montana and hand-cutting every connection. And in my work, similar to the drawings, the connection is probably more important than the area between the connections.
Mm-hmm.
So in making reference to the human form, we're saying that the elbow and the wrist are more important than the bone that connects those two.
Mm-hmm.
So these were people that understood the aesthetic that I was interested in. And so it was, and it probably will be, the longest lasting piece to date until I get another opportunity. It's only recently that American collectors and or museums and contractors, for that matter, architects, have recognized the fact that wood has the capacity to last for a very long period of time.
Yeah.
So usually people were reticent to use wood because they were concerned with the issues of liability and fire and all these things, which have in the past couple of years been addressed through various forms of technology that doesn't interfere with the, you know, the splendid nature of a natural material.
Stephen, what happens in the case of your installation at the Denver Botanical Gardens? Do they go to another place? I mean, they still exist, those forms?
Well, that's an interesting question because I was torn about that particular piece. There were 35 individual sculptures that were made for that.
I wish I'd been able to see them. It looked beautiful.
Yeah, the photographs are great, and the film is, there are two films, and they're both really spectacular. I made a decision early on that I didn't want pieces to survive beyond their life, and meaning the life of the work of art, so that...
For that intended purpose, or...?
Yeah, for that intended purpose, exactly.
Okay, so once they were installed there, then that's the beginning and the end.
That's the beginning, and then in the beginning... In the earlier days of some of the pieces, we used to take them out of the water. And mind you, a lot of these pieces were floating on the water.
Mm-hmm.
We took these pieces out, and they were burned. And they were burned purposefully because I didn't want them to end up in situations where I could not control where they would end up. So what I would do is burn them and harvest the ashes and mix them with the dirt of some of the areas where I would make these structures. I did a piece at the Russell Wright Design Center in Manitoba along the Hudson, and I had a floating piece there that was essentially incinerated at the end, and then we mixed it with the dirt from the surrounding quarry. This piece was in a pond that was in a quarry. And then I jarred up all of the ashes so that it became an addition of the piece itself. Eventually, the pieces, many of them in the early days, were designed to deteriorate, such as most ephemeral art does. But I wanted to make sure that they didn't end up on somebody's lawn.
Yeah.
Quite simply.
No, understood. I mean, the integrity of the piece requires you have a hand in how it's presented.
How it's destroyed. And I stopped burning them because I discovered that it was a bad carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. And so we would just hire a grinder, like one of those tree grinders, and shred them that way.
And then you use that material to give new life somewhere else somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And many times, because they were rendered useless in terms of a growing organism, we would bury the powdered form of the material in with the earth that surrounded the actual site, so that there was a beginning, a middle, and an end. So there was a narrative to the entire structure.
Sure.
And
you
then
know,
go ahead. No, I was going to say, in one case, I used the charred remains of a piece to make a wall drawing.
Oh.
And in that sense, there was a new type of art life given to the old, as a result of the old piece.
Wow. And that was permanent, the wall drawing?
No, it eventually got whitewashed, but it was like one of those WPA murals.
Oh, I see.
Came along and said, this wall looks dirty.
Oh, no.
And so that was covered over. But, you know, things like that happen. regrettably, but it had a life.
Yeah.
And that's important. And because the materials once had an important life and an important contribution to the environment, I don't want them to end up in a place which is incongruous to their implied intention in life. That sounds bigger than it actually is, but, you know, I want them to remain genuine. So,
well, because, I mean, you're so concerned about intimacy, and that's the placement of whatever you create.
Yeah.
Has to be something that you are comfortable with.
Well, it's fueled, it's informed by still the love of drawing, because mm-hmm. all of those aspects of intimacy that we talk about, you know, the simple gesture, the act of pencil on paper, all of those have to come across in the sculpture.
Well, I was very fascinated by your notion that, you know, that sculpture is just a continuation of the drawing, a continuation of the line. And also your notion that there's such dynamism within repetition, you know, seemingly the same line, the same form in repetition still becomes a variable. And that enables your, that allows you to be spontaneous and to be, you know, kind of free-flowing in creating your structures.
That, I mean, you've hit on two important words that are at the core of my work, which is variable repetition. And that comes out of architecture. But more importantly, it comes out of asymmetry, because none of my structures are symmetrical. And the fact that they're not symmetrical has everything to do with that, that there's no measurement. And where does that come from? It comes from the human form, because as skeletons, as bodies, we are not perfectly symmetrical. And I found that there was something rich in architecture that was asymmetrical. So, you know, the first architecture that ever appealed to me was on paper, but it, you can be very asymmetrical on paper. But the Russian constructivists as a group were the first group of architects, the futurist architects, people who kept their architecture on paper.
I have a couple other questions I wanted to put before you. Oh, you mentioned Tippett Rise.
Yeah.
Which I keep trying to get there. It's such a remote place, so hard to make that happen. I will get there.
Well, it was the best year.
Right. Well, yeah. For obvious reasons. But when Tippett Rise brought you in to create the sculpture, did they have an interest in your drawings as well?
They didn't know I drew.
Oh.
That relationship was created as a result of my installation at Storm King.
I see.
They discovered the piece, Stream, which I did at Storm King in 2009, which was a part of their 50th anniversary. And at the time, the people who were the founding the founding people, the founders behind Tippett Rise, were traveling around the country, around the world, to look at different sculpture parks to get a sense as to what might work and what they wanted. And apparently they had gone to Storm King, and they're still very much active with the Storm King community. They saw my piece, and they wanted to bring my piece to Tippett Rise. And the curator at Storm King, a gentleman by the name of David Collins, informed them that the piece was actually site-specific, and so that all of the engineering was really geared towards a very specific location at Storm King, and it could not be transported, but that I might be interested in doing something at Tippett Rise. So that's how that started. They did not really know that I had, the people at Tippett Rise did not know that I did any drawing until they visited my studio for the first time, which was about 2 years after I started working with them on some ideas for sculpture.
What do you think about the idea that drawing is so integral to your artistry? And you're out there now getting these wonderful opportunities to do site-specific work where your artistry is in communion with nature. Shouldn't the drawings be a part of that somehow?
They should.
I mean,
be.
I know inherently in the structure, but they are so much a part of your artistry, and so I wonder about not acknowledging the sculptures in the context of the larger body of work.
The drawings still serve as the primary point of interest for me and the primary point of departure. And the drawing is never used as a means to define what a sculpture is going to look like.
Right. They're not the preparatory drawings at all.
Interestingly enough, a lot of that And I don't mean to bring up anything as crass as marketplace, but I have fewer opportunities to show drawing. And I used to only show drawings until I started to make sculpture. And generally what has happened is that I would love to do drawing shows again. It's a matter of the timing and the interest, but people still acquire the drawings. That's not it. What has happened is that the sculpture has revitalized or reinvigorated the interest in the drawings, and the drawings have proved to be an incredible reflection of the sculptural process.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one thing I never wanted to do, Joanne, was I never wanted my drawings to be illustrations of sculpture.
Right.
Nor did I want the sculpture to be in response. I didn't want the drawings to be in response.
Well, it's so obvious when you walk in the studio that that's the case.
Yeah, also I wanted this sort of curious dichotomy, I think that's the right word, where you didn't know where the drawing ended and the sculpture began.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't want, when someone like yourself would walk into the studio, you would look at the body of work in mass, and some things look like sculpture, but they're drawings, and some things look like drawings and they're sculpture.
Well, what's been important to me as a collector of drawings, you know, is that when I buy a drawing from an artist whose primary work is painting or sculpture or ceramics, that the drawing that I purchase is somehow reflective of the artistry, that gives me a hint of what the full scope of your work is about. Not always easily achieved, but it's exciting when that happens, because, you know, all artists should be working on paper, or should be drawing or taking notes or journaling. If putting pen to paper in some fashion, I think it's critically important to the creative process. But if I look at a body of drawings and I can't relate it at all to the rest of the work, then I have a concern.
Yeah,
but I'm not looking for at all. I'm looking for a distinction, as you said, a dichotomy.
I'm looking for the seamless relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And my heart, I mean, this is as basic as a response as I can give anyone, which is completely heartfelt, and that is my love will always be drawing. And anything that I've done has come out of that love of drawing. And I'm fortunate because drawing was the first, you know, child impulse when it came to being creative. And I learned so much about drawing by just doing it.
And observing.
So, observing. Mm-hmm. But I never had, you know, I just gave a talk, ironically, virtually. I have a show up in Rome. And I talked about the two of the more important drawing teachers that I ever had were photographers. And that was at RISD, one of them being Aaron Siskin and the other being Harry Callahan. And the two of them talked about black and white in a way that made me want to draw. And this was decades ago. I got in trouble for only wanting to draw because no art school would allow me to go for a degree because I wanted to commit 100% of my time to drawing. And the other side of that is that when I got out of graduate school, I got out of Tyler. I drew 20 years before I even thought about sculpture.
Amazing. You know, I was very taken when I was doing some research to come up. Well, let me back up. Let me say that I think you're living a dream, because your artistry was defined at a very young age. You knew as a very young boy what your interest was, and it's never really ventured far from those original visions when you were. I love the story of the you're gazing upon a roller coaster and the structure of the roller coaster, and then some assignment you did at the age of 8 with toothpicks. And I the vision I have of both of those moments takes me to where you are. And I think how fortunate for you to have such a passion identified at such a young age, and then to have just been unyielding in your quest.
I will tell you, quite frankly, it has not always been easy because of the pushback that was initially started in the academic community, because I grew up at a time when drawing was perceived as a relegated to a low-level secondary art form. It was not until the 90s that I was in a group show at the Drawing Center, for instance, in, I believe, 95. And I think right about in the 90s, when I had come back, when I had completed my degrees, that's when everybody was drawing. And I think as good as that was, I also think it was problematic, because I don't want to say not everybody can draw, because then you're making an objective judgment in a subjective arena. But I think that drawing became an arena for people to really wander artistically. And I think other arenas have taken the place of drawing. But I think that drawing came into its own in the 2000s. And I thought that there was some serious stuff going on. Serious is always up for debate, but what I found interesting, too, and you know of my days when I was with Marlboro, is that the people that were buying my drawings primarily came out of the arena of old master drawing collectors. And there was very little contemporary drawing at that time when I first joined Marlboro. When I left Marlboro, drawing had proliferated and everybody was drawing. For me, it's interesting that you say going back to that early experience, drawing was as much of a babysitter for me. I think that it's not exposing too much to let you know that I had severe learning disabilities when I was a child, and that drawing was the tool and the process that prevented me from digging myself deeper into an academic quagmire. And I almost want to say drawing saved my life, because in many ways.
I mean, do you know how many artists I've spoken to who've shared that with me?
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's not uncommon.
It's a hard thing to recognize in hindsight. I was fortunate enough to have, you know, the one or two teachers, but I'm thinking back when I was 5 years old and I could not read, or 6 years old, and I could not read, but I developed this little trick, which a lot of artists do in the beginning, and that was I could walk into a room, and then I could go into another room, and I could draw every item in that room from memory.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was that I was using drawing as a means to improve my capacity to remember activities and events. And the roller coaster in particular, I mean, the ride on that roller coaster at Hershey Park was one of the most traumatic experiences of my life. But it resulted in really what I would consider to be my first piece of sculpture, which was to use Elmer's glue and wooden toothpicks to recreate
right.
it. And I was all of about 7 or 8 years old at the time.
Well, I mean, I really loved when I came upon those stories and made total sense to me. You know, you're working most often in the unknown. You know, you have a starting point, but where it's going to end is unknown, other than you have certain parameters you have to stay within, I guess, especially with some of the new commissions. But, you know, your interest in exploring and taking risks is, I think, fascinating.
Well, it's counter to the way that most people, I'm going to say, it's not a generalization, but most artists my age who are at a point where they're settled into what they're doing. And this was one of the points that I made the other night when I was talking to primarily graduate students. And that was, I always use this Chinese fable to talk about how one should proceed, and that is a young boy comes back from war, from fighting in battles for 15 years, and he sees his father for the first time, and he's a man in his early 30s, and his father says to him, "My son, essentially, now that you don't have to go back to battle, what is your plan? What are you thinking of?" And the young man said, "I had plenty of time to think about it, and I've decided to do X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3. And he went down this very fixed timeline of everything he wanted to accomplish and when he wanted to accomplish it. And he had his entire life planned out. And the father, who was probably a man in his 70s, said to him, "Look, I have one recommendation for you. Don't overplan things, and I want you to live your life more like a cork removed from a bottle that has been thrown into a stream. And I want you to allow yourself the opportunity to go with the current and see where it takes you."
Oh, what a
not to control it.
That's beautiful.
And I always thought, I heard that story maybe 20 years ago. And I thought at the time, what an incredibly courageous way to lead your life. And we all get, we meaning art students, tend to get out of school with these grand plans as to how we're going to achieve something, whether it's success, financial, or the rewards of celebritydom or whatever it is. But one finds that, for me at least, that I love every day coming to the studio and discovering something new, that everything is an invention, that drawing is the primary tool to facilitate that exploration, and it's unbridled. And it takes you places where you never thought you would go. So you function like a cork in a stream. You don't try to determine where you're going to go. You just allow things to happen as a result of working. And you work, in my mind, when you're a professional, you work every day. And, you know, so that's my little side fable.
No, I think it's beautiful. No, I love it. I mean, it does require that you be very present.
Yeah.
And very aware. And that's very hard today with so much noise around us.
Well,
but,
it's very hard to do that, too.
That's why I think journaling or putting pen to paper in some fashion is becoming ever more important for an artist's practice, because there's just so much buried in your mind that can be released when you just spontaneously let yourself and your ideas and thoughts flow. I mean, I see that in artist journals all the time, and it's profound.
Yeah, it gets harder the older you get, because you are prone to the distraction of frustration. And then the other thing, too, that sort of like the bad medicine that art schools give young artists, is that that there is that timeline that you have to achieve certain things by certain times, or else you're not relevant. And the reality, too, is that the art world, as we know it, can be fickle. You know, it's not a level playing field. It requires a belief in what you do, but also the acknowledgement that you can't control what's going to happen.
No, but you can control how you want to be.
Oh, absolutely.
And how you want your work to be in that universe. You know, it strikes me, I started the collection probably 16 years ago, and in the 2000s. And what I've seen happen with drawings, works on paper in that period of time has been nothing short of astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, I mean, I had to hunt and peck to find drawings. You know, I had to go to the flat files or in the back rooms. And, you know, drawing exhibitions were rare. Now, on any given day, other than this last year, you could walk through Chelsea and see any number of galleries showing really magnificent drawing exhibitions. And I suspect, looking ahead, I think 2020 took a lot of artists to the page, took them to drawings, to work on paper, for all the obvious reasons, and I suspect over the next couple of years we're just going to see an explosion of all kinds of drawings, and I'm eagerly anticipating that and look forward to it. But I think back to my question with you is, I think there's a moment here now with your recognitions, your sculpture and your installation work and being in nature, that the drawings could easily come to the forefront in the right situation. I think you just have to make it known that that's important to you.
It's very important to me, and I hope you can still hear me. Is that right?
I can. Yeah, okay. It's a little, sounds like you're in a tunnel, but I can hear you.
I'm sorry. It's an industrial building, and when people put on their saws, I have to sort of change.
Oh, those. Okay. Sorry.
In all honesty, I have been trying to get the drawings out more, and was very productive during the pandemic when it came to drawing, because I had to stop most of my sculptural activities.
Mm-hmm.
When I showed at Marlboro, to their credit, they were very supportive of my drawings. The art world is changing. If anything, there is that virtual component that has been added to it that did not exist before, there are aspects of it, I think, that are not going to return to the, you know, to the old days, good old days, for instance, of, you know, the four walls.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still committed to, you know, if you say to me what activity means the most and what would you most like to be recognized for, mm-hmm. it would always be drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always going to be a constant. What has happened is that drawing has been this positively distracting activity, which has taken me into these other areas.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to every once in a while pull myself back. As I sit here and talk to you, I've pulled out a bunch of drawings that I started during the pandemic. And it's interesting because without the emotional situation that the pandemic afforded, you approach them in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And, for instance, I was not allowed in my studio for 6 weeks, and I was extremely productive doing drawings on the kitchen table. And it reminded me of being a child after dinner when my mom would clear off the dinner dishes and wash down the table and let me draw. And that was special. And it was much the same life that happened again. It was different now. But, you know, after dinner, my son, to his credit, would wash off the table for me so that I could draw. And I was very prolific as a result of emotional states, which I had never dealt with before.
Well, it's something for you to think about when you're having this film done tomorrow or whenever it is soon about your work and COVID. I mean, I think that's an important thing to recollect.
I think it's powerful.
It's a powerful image.
It is.
And also in the context of the work that's going to, you know, there's going to be a wealth of exhibitions coming up having to do with artists and their artistry and how it was impacted by this virus. And, you know, that could be a time for some of your drawings to really find a place.
Yes, from your lips to God's ears.
I'm just giving you some food for thought.
Oh, no. The reality is that...
Especially now in the midst of, you know, I mean, you've got these great commissions. You have this big thing coming up in Brazil. You're incorporating film, which is, you know, documenting a lot about your process, but this is missing from that whole thing.
Oh, absolutely. And, I never forgot the surprising moment when Marlboro first came to my studio to look at my sculpture. And, you know, Pierre Levay, former direct owner, CEO of Marlboro. And he came into my studio and looked at the drawings, and he looked at me and he said, "Oh, you draw too." And I'll never forget that line, because after all, I had been drawing for nearly 25 years before I made a sculpture.
Laughable.
It is kind of laughable. I look back on it. But I mean, this is an aside, but I'm still in the process of trying to recreate that situation in terms of gallery representation. You know, people that are willing to show drawings exclusively or drawings in addition to the sculpture that I do. And it's a different world out there in terms of...
Well, I think they can both be. I mean, they can walk hand in hand. I just think it's possible. I think it's a matter of finding the right place. And,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, you're gaining momentum now with these magnificent opportunities to construct sculptures in nature, so, or even in interiors. So I think just keep that in the forefront. And when you're having discussions with these curators, you just have to make this known, plant the seed.
Yeah.
You know, you get two tunnel vision sometimes. I mean, I had imagined that Tippett Rise had some of your drawings exhibited in some of their interior spaces.
They actually do own a couple of drawings, but they put them in their private spaces.
Well, that's good.
Private,
at least they have them.
Yeah, that's great.
That's something.
The other thing I've been very fortunate about over these years, specific to drawing, is that most of the drawings have been acquired by museums. And
well, that's great.
That's a wonderful seal of approval.
Yeah.
To have that experience over the past 40 years.
For sure.
Since school.
Yeah. No, that's, well, it's an important part of your professional development and recognition. It's where you want them to be. Well, I've exceeded 45 minutes, I think. Oh, not too bad. We've done well. I'm ever grateful to you for taking the time today. I know how busy you are, and I love talking about your work. The whole time I'm sitting here envisioning some of the sculptures, and I just can't thank you enough, and I'll very much look forward to what happens in Brazil.
Well, I will keep you posted, and thank you so much, and a delight to hear from you again after so long.
Thank you. Well, we'll stay in touch, and
good.
I appreciate catalogs, and you know, I hold my memories of being in your studio very dear. It was the first time I had met an artist working with dental tools to draw.
That's right. There is a film short with me using a power sander on one of my drawings. So that's recorded.
Yes. Well, Stephen, best to you, and thank you
again.
Thank
you so much.
You stay well, and I'll look forward. Maybe the
you
next
too.
Time I'll see you, you'll be in your new space and back in Manhattan.
Great. Thank you so
good.
Much, Joanne.
Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye.